So welcome back to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I'm your host, Greg. Today we have another different type of interview with an external person that's not just Ronak and I. So today we're going to be talking to Tracy Keene, the CEO of Mate Fertility, and how she got into this world and where she thinks it's going to go in the future. Tracy, you want to say hello and give us a little bit about yourself and where you came from and how you got to Mate?
Hey, Greg. Yeah, thanks for having me. Number one, excited to be here. And I'll give you the high level on my background, but feel free to double click anywhere you like. I started out my career in the investment industry in Boston many years ago. I was an SEC accountant, so I priced mutual funds, which, as you can see, natural segue into fertility. And then I did back and middle office operations with a bank that later got acquired by State Street. I went to a boutique firm, fixed income, that had about $6.7 billion under management at the time, and I did analytics and controller work for them. By the time I left there, they had about $27 billion under management, and I moved out to Los Angeles, and I started consulting. I was an industry agnostic consulting for just about 11 years, and I would do operational assessments of businesses, and then I would help them fix the broken pieces. Around the fourth or fifth business that I consulted with, I did my operational assessment and came to the conclusion and recommendation that they close the business down. And so I helped them unwind that business. And that sort of became a niche that I worked in. I did a lot of restructuring, relocating, winding down of businesses, in addition to optimizing businesses. But I always say you uncover the bodies on the backside of things. And that's also where you kind of learn a lot. It gave me a lot of exposure to legal, HR, and other items that I bring with me, in addition to my operational and accounting background to what I do at Mate. I came on board in 2021 as the head of finance. At the time, they had just launched their first clinic. They were doing a little fundraising and wanted to optimize their team. I really liked what they were doing on three levels. I'll say the personal levels. I grew up in the rural South. The geographic access to care approach that Mate is taking really spoke to me just on an individual level. Also, I'm a member of the LGBTQ community, the focus on access to care for that community, and also just the inherent knowledge that third party is something that is a tool that's been, it doesn't have the same sort of adoption friction, I would say, among the LGBTQ community that it does among other communities. And also just on a nerd level, the business model is pretty innovative and brilliant, and I liked it. It's super efficient, really ROI-based, which is different than a lot of what we see in equity markets, especially historically. It's a cash flow model that runs pretty leanly and scalably. That really excited me on that level. And so I came on board and started getting to work, rolling up my sleeves.
Yeah, so that I think is one of the most interesting pieces of all this for your story. I don't see too many companies that hire somebody like a head of finance, A, that early, but then have that person end up as a CEO of the company. So how did that conversation go down between, I think it's two co-founders of the company, two brothers, is that correct?
That's correct.
And how did they end up having that conversation with you and saying, hey, I read a little bit of the TechCrunch article in terms of like how that went down, but from your own words, how did the two co-founders approach you and say, we actually want you to take the reins and become the CEO of this company? Like, how did that happen, and why did you say yes?
Yeah.
If you're willing to share.
It happened a little differently than that, but Gabriel Wagner, who is still on the team and very proactively involved, he was the first brother that I met, and he really sold the passion of the mission to me. The other brother who was with the company, he, phenomenal salesperson, phenomenal fundraiser, really had kind of taken this idea and gotten it where it was. And there were some conversations that were going on before I came on board about utilizing those strengths and then pairing it with some more operational chops on the other side. And I think it just became really apparent what the model needed was that operational complexity, that understanding of the operational complexity and that experience leveraged and backed by the financial understanding and awareness of the model and how to capitalize on ROI while growth mindset, etc. It wasn't the prettiest situation, if I'm being totally honest, but ultimately I think that it was a decision that was made in the best interest of the business, because I think what we always have to remember as fiduciaries of any institution that we're working with is that it's not about us as individuals. It's about giving businesses a chance to succeed in the best way possible. that can benefit the most. And that's how I approach everything. And fortunately, we have a good team and a good board that is looking out in that direction for how do we make this successful? Because it's really something, the mission is super important here. And I always say to our team internally, if we don't succeed, we don't know that anybody's going to come behind us and pick up the reins where we left off. And something's got to give in this industry because the access to care issue is just so dramatic. And we can get into the specifics of the numbers, but I feel really personally compelled to give this business every chance it has to succeed.
Yeah, I think you hit on a really interesting point that I'll just double click on for the physicians that have listened to a lot of these episodes already, is the idea of the startup as the thing that you're protecting. It's not necessarily the founders of the company. Like when you're starting a company, you sign a lot of documents with vesting schedules and NDAs and everything that are meant to protect the company, not necessarily you as the founder of that company. So that's something to keep in mind, is especially when investors invest in a company, they're not necessarily, they're investing likely sometimes because of the founder, but they're not investing into the founder. They're investing into the company. That's ultimately the thing that is either going to succeed or fail, and ultimately either exit or not, is the company, not the founder. So keep that in mind, especially for those that are angel investing, is sometimes you do invest for the founder. Sometimes you invest because it's such a good idea. And if something happens with the founding team and things change, it does happen, right? Throughout startup world, it happens all the time where founders decide to leave or whatever it is, but you're investing into the company. That's the Delaware C Corp, not necessarily the founder. So that's an interesting kind of point to take. All right, let's jump into a little bit about Mate and what exactly is the business model, because a lot of the listeners are physicians. I don't know how many of them are OBGYNs, but let's jump into a little bit about what it is that you guys are actually tackling and what does the business model look like right now, at least.
Yeah. So first and foremost, I'll say Mate Fertility is an MSO, and that becomes really important in sort of the scalability of our model and what we're trying to do. So there are a lot of startups out there in the fertility space, but I would say pretty squarely that most of them are focused on the demand side of the solution. And if we look at the numbers, they're not great. They're not big numbers. So in 2021, 300,000 cycles performed. And just to meet demand, and some argue this number is a little on the low side, and we could get into that if we want, we would have needed to do 3 million. So all of those demand side solutions, while I think they're amazing, there's a lot of people out there doing a lot of amazing things in the space. If we're all fighting for the same 300,000 cycles, that's not a very big piece of pie. What Mate says is, let's bake a bigger pie, because the supply side is really the limiting factor here. And what I mean by that is there aren't enough providers and there aren't enough clinics. So 85% of clinics are located in top 10 markets or adjacent to top 10 markets. And historically, it's pretty limited view demographically of who's receiving these services. And we can get deeper into that as well. What Mate's model is to upskill, train OB-GYNs to perform these services, facilitate the build out of a top of the line lab facility for them, educate them, and that's a pretty involved proprietary process that we follow, and then oversee QA QC, and we take key pieces of the administrative process as well in the remote environment to really wrap it around the patient, make it an optimized patient experience, less administratively burdensome for the doctors, and then also a lot of QA QC and compliance elements of our model where we're really facilitating a data-driven approach to optimizing outcomes.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the numbers, because that's something that you realize when you're going through medical school and you're doing all these rotations in OBGYN, or ultimately maybe you go do 1 or 2 days of REI work with somebody. Do you know how many reproductive endocrinologists actually are trained in the U.S.?
There's about 1,200 currently, give or take, 1,300. I know that the number that are accepted into the fellowship is roughly 40, give or take, yeah, as
it's
well.
It's like one of the most difficult fellowships to get into out of any specialty, subspecialty. It's just such a small number.
Yeah. And then when we look at the number that are retiring or exiting practice, we're not even at replacement rate for that. And OB-GYNs really are able to practice this at the top of their license. It's really enabling these practitioners to do what they can at the top of their license, but also in a really controlled way so that we're optimizing for safety and outcomes.
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting piece of this model too, is that you guys are upskilling physicians that are already in practice doing something, right? That's one of the large investment theses for a lot of different folks that are investing into healthcare is like the upskilling process and what you can do to, again, get people to practice at the top of their license, which is really what you want to do as a physician, to hopefully not burn out also. What does that process look like to go from, hey, I'm a practice owner in the Midwest and I want to offer my community IVF services? How long does that take to actually get on the ground and start treating patients? And what does that actually look like for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's about a 6 to 12 month process, depending on a number of factors, right? Obviously, if there's heavy construction involved, depending on what type of construction that is, that can be a limiting factor. But I'll break it apart into the education, the project management, and then the MSO services specifically. So our education is broken up into three key areas: didactic learning, which is through a proprietary LMS that we built, and that's accompanied by lectures with our reproductive endocrinology team and our HCLD lab directors. In addition to that, we have simulators, simulation training with actual oocyte retrieval simulators and transfer simulators. And we also do case simulation so that we're really preparing them. And then we do precepting and proctoring with them. And what that means is when they're doing their first cases, we have a reproductive endocrinologist present with them on site, licensed in that state to facilitate that process. And similarly to the fellowship, there are inflection points. We want to look at how are these providers doing? What is the maturity rate, et cetera? There are very set benchmarks that we're looking for when we're assessing how well these providers are doing.
And that's another thing that I want to jump into is, have you gotten feedback from other RAIs throughout the country that have heard of what you're doing with upskilling general OB-GYNs? And has there been pushback? Has there been, hey, we finally have maybe a solution for rural America that doesn't get an REI in the community? What has that response been from other reproductive endocrinologists? Because I'm assuming that's mostly going to be who's interested in kind of what you're doing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we as a population of people are a bit change averse, right? And especially when we work hard and we do some specialized training, we immediately have that knee, like that reflex of, nope, they can't do it. Don't take away this. It's mine. Which I say, that's really not the point. Like when I look at it, I don't want to call out the REIs for building a system that's not scalable, right? I want to call them in and say, hey, I'm sure that you never intended or never had any inclination that infertility rates would be where they are today. And probably we would have built things differently if we knew that then, what we know today. But taking a solution-based approach, if we're able to partner with, work with reproductive endocrinologists to come up with best practices for how this should be done, which is really what we're building into our model. What are the best practices? As it stands, each center is doing it their own way. What is the data telling us? What should we be doing? I think we all know with AI nowadays, you can go in and type, give me a protocol for X, and it's going to spit something out that is within a degree of reasonability. Not a bad protocol, right? So I think what we're trying to do is say, hey, help us distribute this knowledge in a meaningful way, oriented towards delivering more access to something that the World Health Organization is raising their alarm bells about right now, saying this is an increasing problem. Help us do it and help us do it. So I think we have a natural inclination as human beings to be change averse. We have a natural inclination to not think outside of our linear patterns of thinking. And all we're saying is, hey, there's got to be a better way. And there's a way to do it with high standards, delivering high outcomes that everybody can align on at least from a data perspective. And we have good clinical pregnancy rates. We're above the national average. It's something that can and should be done, I think. And the only person losing out if we don't make some meaningful change in this space is the patient.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And let's jump into how many clinics are up and running currently. And then, yeah, if you have more pieces of data of what does the kind of success rate look like and all of those kind of metrics, if you can share them, and then if you have those off the top of your head.
Yeah, we have two mains up and running and a satellite, and then we have two more coming online or scheduled to come online this year. And we have quite a few providers in the pipeline as well. Our goal in this next phase is really growth. It's really to increase that number of clinics that we have. be able to batch providers through rather than just doing one opening at a time. I think one of the things we look at is how do we have a rinse and repeat process for this? We do take a playbook like a franchise. We don't want to reinvent the wheel with every practice we're opening because the thesis of what we're doing is standardization. And I think that's something that this industry would really benefit a lot from, standardization of measurement and how are we doing what we're doing, all the way soup to nuts. How are we building our facilities? How are we educating these providers and training these providers? And so our goal is to have at least 4 to 6 come online next year. So doubling that clinic count year over year is really the goal.
Yeah, I think that becomes an interesting question for the other physician listeners of this podcast. We had one on scalability. So I guess the question is, how do you take this process and scale it at a fast enough pace that you're able to make a pretty big difference in the space? I think that's going to be an interesting question for you guys to solve as you move forward. Also, full disclosure, I should put this in the beginning. Maybe I'll reposition this. My wife is an investor in Mate in their Series A, which are you guys closed for the Series A or is it still open?
So it's closing on the 30th. So we're 5 days away. Nice. We are piggybacking the round. So it was a $20 million pre-money valuation, $5 million raise. And we are piggybacking that with a community round that we're opening on WeFunder so that because it's such a community-driven model, we actually feel like it's really important to give people access. Democratizing access, I think, makes a difference, not just on the investment front, but also on you got to have a 360-degree view of these things. So we are opening that community round on the heels of the A, which closes on the 30th.
Nice. Congrats. That's awesome. Was it an inside round or was it external institutional capital that came in?
Both. So we had re-up from existing investors, but we also had some pretty significant external investors, Cortado Ventures and Oklahoma Life Sciences Fund, both invested in the round and amazing investors. And then Strut Capital and Revolutions Rise of the Rest and Vituity Inflect Health also re-upped significantly in the round.
And so since this podcast is about valuations and everything like that, was the valuation the same as the first round? Was it higher this round? Was it an up round? Was it a down round? Was it flat?
It was an up round. We obviously the macro environment is pretty tough right now. Do I feel like a year and a half ago, we probably could have gotten a little bit heavier or heftier valuation? Probably. Do I think that I come from a fixed income background and I believe that you want to be able to perform to whatever you raise and whatever your valuation is. And I feel really comfortable with where we're at, being able to perform and outperform that ideally. And the next round, because our model is lean, it's CapEx light. Ideally, it's a very strategic round. We're not necessarily going to be as cash flow constrained as other companies because we do turn cash flow positive pretty quickly, which is exciting.
Yeah. So for the startup founders out there that are trying to raise at a $50 million pre-money valuation and you have no revenue, keep that in mind that you're going to have to clear markets in the Series A, Series B, Series C if you're going to continue building your company. This is a company that has actual revenue coming through the door with actual physical clinics that they've built that's raising at a $20 million pre-money valuation, which is pretty reasonable in this environment. And what is that funding that you guys are raising? So the $5 million, what is that going towards? Is that hiring? Is that marketing? What does that look like for you guys?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Strategic hiring, obviously. The way that we look and function internally is how do we get more efficient as we scale? I always look around and say solutions exist everywhere. Perhaps they just haven't been applied here yet. And so that's the lens through which I view growth. And I also think that people are happier when they're productive. And what productivity means is not doing the banal, not doing repetitive work. We're really building in a lot of workflows and automations. Again, how do we scale what we do? We make it repeatable and we build in workflows and systematizations for our communications and process with our partners, even down to the QA QC protocols that we're using to make sure that it's really clear and apparent how to do this and how to do it in a rinse repeat manner rather than every clinic being its own exception. A little bit of marketing. What we're really hoping as we grow is that Mate Fertility becomes the well-known household name for high quality, more affordable, geographically accessible care. So really anchoring all of our messaging around that on the marketing side is really important. We want to be a place where people can go to ask questions. Our call center, on average, before we ever send a patient into the office for a new patient visit or a fertility assessment, We're having 4 and 5 conversations with them because people just have questions. There's a lot of information out there. People don't know what's right. It's hard to get apples to apples comparisons. You don't know what data is being cherry picked or patients are being cherry picked to improve outcomes, et cetera. So we really try to just make sure to spend a lot of time agnostically answering questions for patients about what treatments are, how much they're going to cost. And we also take a really intentional approach to how we talk to patients so that we're not unintentionally alienating any populations of people, whether it's single people, LGBTQ people, groups that have historically been a little bit marginalized, either just from the process itself or the way the consents are written that nobody even takes time to think about. So we try to be real intentional there and make sure that we have a process that's oriented towards educating patients as well.
Couple last questions that we'll end on. Are there any certain cities in the U.S. that you guys are looking to expand to next? So if there is anybody that's listening that's, hey, I'm interested in kind of what you guys are doing, like where are you guys targeting next? So I think your main hub's what, Oklahoma right now?
Yeah. So our flagship's Oklahoma. We have some activity in Virginia. We got Pittsburgh. We also have a couple of locations we're in conversation with in Texas. But what I would say about what we like about certain communities, if your patients, if you're already doing monitoring for other facilities because your patients can't make the trip an hour and a half, 2 hours while they're in cycle, we tend to look at where are population centers where there's not an REI clinic within a 2-hour drive. That's a good indication that's going to be a good market for us. So secondary, tertiary cities where there's either limited or no access immediately in that ecosystem to reproductive and endocrinology care.
Is Pittsburgh really limited?
Pittsburgh is an interesting market, and there's a lot of academic availability there. But what we're really trying to build with this particular partner, who is very socially motivated on a democratization front, is they want to get the price as low as they possibly can and just provide that access point. They had some interesting iterations of experiences there with some patients. And so they just thought, hey, this is something that I'm passionate about, increasing access and family building. And so let's go. The catchment area for Pittsburgh is also pretty massive. When we look that's right. So when we look at the total catchment area for Pittsburgh, that was one of the things when we looked at the pros and cons of that market. West Virginia doesn't have any access to care. Ohio, limited access. So total catchment area was pretty attractive in that market versus necessarily the baseline lack of ability. It was more about providing that broader socioeconomic access.
That's interesting. Any questions I should have asked you?
Ooh, no, I think you touched on everything. I'm really excited about where we are. It's a tough macro environment out there. And I think I always feel like we're moving in the right direction when I get a lot of inbound inquiry to partner up and sync up with what we're doing. I think there's also an increasing awareness that something's going to give in this area. And so we might as well work together. Again, I always like to say, let's collaborate here instead of compete, because we're 2.7 off the mark in meeting demand. So we got a long ways to go. What's the point of infighting?
I think the strategy that you guys are taking, instead of building a software platform or something, you guys are doing something that's a little bit harder, probably a lot harder, in terms of having a real world impact versus being another app or something like that. I like that you guys are actually going out and saying, we're going to partner with physicians and build actual clinics versus doing something else. That's also nice to see. It's not an easy thing that you're doing, but it definitely can actually increase access to real life physicians that can actually treat you in real life.
Yeah, I agree. I also think too, last thing I'll say, from the response that we get from a lot of OB-GYNs, I think a lot of doctors go into medicine to do something meaningful, and it's hard. It's tough out there for medical practitioners. OB-GYNs are very overworked and overtaxed, and it's a tough situation. So hopefully this is something that the right kinds of providers who are interested in providing a different type of care or learning something new, we get really excited about those partnerships.
And also for the OB-GYNs out there too, it's like maybe you did want to go into REI and it was 30 people or 40 people that got into a fellowship spot. That's an insane small number of people that actually get into that. I thought my residency was small, but when you think about REI and only 30 or 40 spots, whatever it is, that's extremely small. So, and I know there's a lot of people that are interested in that space. But
that's right. There's a lot of people out there that wanted to learn how to do this and just haven't been able to. So it's a pretty exciting prospect, I think. And thanks for having me here today, Greg.
Thanks for jumping on. And maybe we'll have you back in a year and see what the progress is.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you, Tracy. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate Podcast.